the reality is that even professional venture investors, where their business is to make investments in early stage companies and make a profit for themselves and their investors, and they do that 24/7, is their job. And even in those instances, most of them do not outperform the public markets. And it's for the reasons I just mentioned. They don't source enough, they don't evaluate well, they don't support well. And that's what they do 100% of the time. Whereas the typical angel investor is someone who has money, they probably have a job, they have kids, they have a lot of things they're doing. They're not seeing a ton of deals a month, they're seeing a handful of deals a year. Some of those deals are from, you know, their friends, the children of their friends, it's people they know. They have a tough time saying no. And then they're not necessarily experts in the sector. Like, literally, you're going to expect them to be a bit worse than the venture funds who do that full time. And if the venture funds most of the time are not outperforming the public markets, then angel investors are doing probably a standard deviation worse.
Welcome to the Sidcast, the podcast where we sit down with a fascinating guest each week to hear their story, who they are, and how they got to be that way. My name is Sid Finkelstein, a professor at Dartmouth College, and your host and guide as we embark on a journey of learning, discovery, and good old-fashioned conversation. Hi there, this is Sid Finkelstein, and this is the Sidcast, episode number 109. And my guest today is Jacques-Philippe Piverger. And it's a pleasure to have Jacques-Philippe with me. He's actually a former student of mine who I've kept in touch with over the years. And he has just had a really fascinating career, chock full of interesting twists and turns, often with a focus on investing and entrepreneurship. He started different companies and scaled them. He's a venture capitalist today, a co-founder and managing partner of Ozone X. And we talk about that a lot in this episode because it's really interesting. And I think he describes himself as an entrepreneur more than anything else. He's got a lot of experience in real estate and venture capital and finance. He's been recognized by the World Economic Forum as a young global leader, by the Council on Foreign Relations as well. He's served in various New York City development corporations and agencies and has really interesting perspective. And I want to just share three quick things to kind of get the ball rolling in this episode. First of all, what is Ozone X? It is a venture capital firm that Jacques-Philippe founded that has a business model of investing in women, Black, and Latinx founders. Why? Because there is much less competition for those companies. In fact, I think he was saying that less than 5% of all venture capital money goes to women-backed startups, which is kind of a crazy thing. And then factor in people of color and the fact that they don't get the same opportunities to tap into all kinds of funding sources. And you actually have kind of an interesting business model, because what Jacques-Philippe and his team is doing is creating a competitive advantage by taking advantage of other people's narrow-mindedness or their traditional views or even their outright bias. And I think that's a really cool idea. That's a smart idea. It's a relatively untapped marketplace, founders that happen to be women or people of color. And as a result, there's a great business opportunity. And by the way, at the same time, he is supporting these companies. And to top it all off, Jacques-Philippe, I think, shares in this podcast episode that the return on investment for venture capitalists or other investors when they back startups created by people of color or women actually are higher than other investments. You actually don't only do good things, but you actually make more money. I mean, that's perfect. That is perfect. And that's what he's doing. And I was actually surprised he wanted to go on the podcast, because now many, many people, including a lot of venture capitalists, are going to hear about Jacques-Philippe and they're going to hear him describe what he's doing. And they're going to say, he's onto something. Why aren't we doing that? And he's going to have more competition. Well, in a way, I hope so, because that would mean there's more money being directed towards minority owned or created startups. And I have a feeling Jacques-Philippe will agree with that, but we'll still be able to find many, many great opportunities. A second point, which doesn't come up in the podcast, but came up recently in my class and then the New York Times article not that long ago about Elizabeth Holmes at Theranos. Some of you may know the Theranos story. It was a startup that ended up, it was worth something like $9 billion with a B, dollars at one point in time. And Elizabeth Holmes was a Stanford University dropout that created this. And she was one of the very, very few women founders of a company in Silicon Valley that was a unicorn, as they say, which is to say a $1 billion valuation. And unfortunately, it turned out that the product didn't work and lots of bad things happened and the company went out of business. And Elizabeth Holmes is currently on trial for fraud. And so it's a pretty serious thing. And this New York Times article referenced the stigma and impact that many women founders of companies face, especially in life sciences, because of Elizabeth Holmes. And in some of the interviews in this article, they talked to some founders, women founders, and they said, you know, they're always asked about Elizabeth Holmes. How do I know you're not another Elizabeth Holmes? How do I know you're legit? And on the one hand, we get that question, but we understand where that question comes from. On the other hand, it's only being directed towards women, but I don't see where men are being asked about, you know, some of the male founders of companies that ended up doing some bad stuff, not necessarily fraud. I'm thinking about Travis from Uber, and I'm thinking about Andy Newman from WeWork. And if you want to talk about fraud, we could talk about Bernie Madoff or go back in time and you have people like Dennis Kozlowski from Tyco and Jeffrey Skilling from Enron and Bernie Ebers from WorldCom. There's no shortage of male CEOs and founders that have screwed up big time. And I don't know that startup founders that happen to be men are being asked those questions the same pace and same rate that women founders are being asked the same question because of Elizabeth Holmes. But that's just another example of the uneven playing field. And yet again, points out how important it is, how valuable it is that Jacques-Philippe Beauverger, what he's working on with Ozone in his business. So there's a lot to talk about. I really do, as you know, longtime listeners of the Sidcast will know, I really like to talk to entrepreneurs. I like to talk to people with entrepreneurial thinking because, you know, they see a problem and rather than complain about it, they do something about that. And they create very often a money-making opportunity around a problem that actually goes a long way towards helping to solve that problem. So this is a great episode. Jacques-Philippe is a fantastic guest and it's great to have him on the Sidcast. Welcome to the Sidcast. This is Sid Finkelstein. My guest today is Jacques-Philippe Beauverger. Hi, Jacques-Philippe.
Hello, Sid. It's good to see you. Good to be here with you.
It's great to have you with us and talking about all sorts of things. You're still young and in the prime of your career, but there's a lot of stuff you've already done that's kind of interesting. It'll be fun to talk about. But let's start with your background. So where'd you grow up?
I answered that in a variety of ways. I remember, you know, our connection with Tuck. I said that I was from Haiti, which is where my entire family's from. I spent every summer there growing up, but I was actually born in New York and I grew up in Miami. So from first to 12th grade, I was in Miami, Florida.
Yeah. Do you still have family in Haiti now?
I do. Most of my family is not in Haiti, but I still have some family there and, you know, general connections.
Yeah,
for sure.
I imagine you follow what's going on there very closely. And, you know, we're airing this podcast a little bit after we're talking, so the news may have moved on. But obviously the coup and the president being assassinated, a lot of people don't quite know what to make of that.
Yeah, it's a very tough situation. Haiti was already challenged to begin with, even before COVID. Obviously, COVID and a global pandemic made it even more challenging. And now with the assassination of the president, that just takes it to a new low, if you will. And I think everyone's still trying to figure out what's happening. And this particular president, Jovenel Moise, I actually moderated a 3-hour conversation with him just a few months ago. And so, you know, for me, it's kind of bizarre slash interesting kind of having that dichotomy of having just spoken to the person and seeing all the ideas. And we had people from all over the world suggesting ideas that could help uplift the country across tech and ag and food and everything else. And now, you know, he's been assassinated and difficult for people living in Haiti, obviously, and people living abroad who have an interest in being supportive to the country. And for me, my core focus these days is building my venture fund, and I try to be, you know, super focused on that. But, you know, I always, as you said, do pay attention and try to be helpful wherever I can.
Yeah. And it seems to me that there's a sizable diaspora of people from Haiti that have moved to, well, probably a lot of places, but especially Canada and United States. Being from Montreal, I know there's a big Haitian population. That's the French legacy of French being a mother tongue. And, you know, people like you that are just thriving and creating business and helping people create businesses. It is a dichotomy, a different type of dichotomy when you see the success of so many people that have roots in Haiti and then the ongoing struggles there that unfortunately it just doesn't seem to get better.
Yeah, no, definitely challenging. And you're right, kind of the locations many Haitians have gone after leaving Haiti. And a lot of it also relates to when they left Haiti. So kind of the big first migration mostly went to New York, kind of early 60s, as well as Montreal. And then the later arrivals were mostly Miami. And then you also have a pretty sizable pocket in Boston because of all the universities there. And then you have internationally as well. So I think generally the idea is there are about 4 million Haitians living outside of Haiti, if you consider the whole diaspora. About half of those are in the U.S. and another half are everywhere else.
Yeah. I remember a number of years ago, you had a company, a startup with, I guess, a solar-powered lanterns and lights, one of many of your earlier ventures. And was that motivated in part from what was going on in Haiti? I think that was the massive earthquake and lack of power. Was that part of that story as well?
It was. It was definitely partially inspired, I would say, by the challenges that I saw in Haiti. And then when I took a step back, I realized that it wasn't only an issue for the 10 million people living in Haiti, but about close to half the planet, who mostly live in Africa, Southeast Asia, Caribbean, Latin America, who are still heavily reliant on wood and kerosene and things of that sort. So you're exactly correct as far as a large part of that inspiration coming from Haiti and the need there. And I think that's something that is worthwhile for people to keep in mind. I think many of the greatest challenges also present the biggest opportunities. And that's something that I've always tried to be mindful of, you know, as I've done different things in the world.
I think that's a great point. It reminds me of different people have made a similar point, even going back to someone like Jeff Immelt, who was the CEO of GE. And, you know, he had an up and down tenure and he followed Jack Welch, which is never going to be easy. But he always said that GE should be innovating to try to solve these intractable problems that are out there, including things like climate change, because there's a lot of money to be made there. So even, I don't want to put words in his mouth, I don't know that he said it, but I'm going to say it this way. Even if you don't actually care a lot about what's going on in the world, you can make a lot of money by helping what's going on in the world, which is kind of a cynical way to look at it. But I mean, if that's what it takes to get people to move the needle, then I guess I'm in favor.
So I'm 100% aligned with what you just mentioned. And I sometimes take it a step even further in that, you know, oftentimes we think of people who are very well off, who are wealthy, who have significant resources as having an advantage as far as being able to get things done. I think there's something to be said about the people who are in the proverbial arena, right? Who are living the everyday challenges, who are living with the 99% of the population, because that's where the big challenges are. And in as far as you can come up with solutions to solve for those, that usually, whether intended or not, translates into significant amassed financial resources or other types of influence. There's definitely a real connection there between, you know, the need and solving for those and success, whether at the corporate or individual level.
And have you noticed solutions and startups coming from other countries that are having these challenges more and more over time? I mean, we think about it as a U.S. thing or a Western economy thing. But your comment made me think, well, maybe there's a lot of energy mainstream people don't seem to know about that's happening in third world countries.
Yeah, and absolutely. We're starting to see a lot more activity coming out of developing markets. And we've seen some developing markets that, you know, we're not sure that we include them in developing anymore, right? So not so long ago, China was considered developing. But in terms of the innovation coming out of there, I think it's ahead of Europe at this point. And it's almost on par with the U.S. and the capital going in and resources going in. You're getting significant stuff coming out of there. That's an example of a country that was definitely developing not so long ago. Now, you know, there are questions depending on how you define it. And then you have the ones that are just outside of that across the Middle East, Africa, Latin America. And so you're definitely seeing more and more big ideas. I was actually speaking with a buddy who I know through the World Economic Forum, who's based in Venezuela. And so that's kind of the extreme example of broken state, had challenges forever. But this guy, he developed a health tech solution over the last 15 years with limited resources, can't raise capital. So literally has to build something that works. And at this point, he has something like 3.5 million Venezuelans on his platform. He's making serious cash, solving for a major problem. And now he's created a global footprint and is actually raising international funds because his solution is better than what's out there. So I think you're going to start seeing more of that because founders who are able to build solutions in some of those places, many of those solutions are applicable to developed markets. And the other thing I would put there is even within the United States or Europe, you kind of have developing markets within the market. And so, you know, the U.S., what is it, 325, 350 million people. A large percentage of that population living in various urban centers, you know, have challenging situations. And we're also seeing many opportunities coming out of there solving for those challenges, whether it's within fintech or edtech or various sectors. And oftentimes, it's a bit easier to get to those communities, at least for us, since we're here in the States. And then we're able to plug them into more resources. So to me, that's part of our thesis. We think there are big ideas housed in communities that have historically been marginalized from the traditional flows of capital. And in some instances, it's almost laughable because you don't have to go to Latin America or Haiti. Like literally in the US, you just go to a woman, like, you know, your friendly female friend who probably did better than you in school and who you know is as smart or smarter. But in the US, they're getting 3% of the capital. And so, you know, there's definitely significant low-hanging fruit that we think we can capitalize on in terms of really bringing to bear meaningful solutions to some of the biggest challenges of our time.
Is that actually an accurate statistic that women entrepreneurs get 3% of the total venture capital money that goes out?
I mean, the number that I've generally seen is about 2.9%. That's why I said it's laughable. It just sounds so absurd.
Yeah,
but
nobody believes
true.
It. I mean, it's yeah, people are not going to believe it. They're going to shake their head. So what you found, in a sense, is a market failure for whatever reasons. There's a market failure and you're developing, as part of your thesis for your whole fund, a way to take advantage of that market failure. And by the way, that happens to do some good things for some important communities. Do you find that there are more, like, is this a trend? Are there more venture capitalists or angel investors or others that are targeting these underrepresented groups that have not had access to the same resources as kind of the mainstream?
Yeah, I think in the last few years, you're starting to see more venture funds come up that are targeting underrepresented groups, whether it's women, Black, Latinx, immigrants, you know, the various sectors that have been under-resourced. And I think you're starting to see them do that for a number of different reasons. And you know, hopefully that trend continues because the need is so big. You know, those groups need to have more options from which to source capital and other resources. And the other interesting fact, which is potentially leading to this, is when you look at the data in terms of performance, whether it's from McKinsey or Kauffman Foundation or BCG and others, they're actually finding that when those groups, whether it's women or Black or Latinx that have largely been marginalized, get capital, they actually return more of it and they return it quicker. And so I tend to look at it as a nice arbitrage opportunity in that I think it's the right thing to do, but it's also just smart. And I expect that difference in terms of performance to persist over the next few cycles. And I'm not saying that it's absolutely the case that this target that we have are better or smarter. They might be, you never know. But it probably also has to do with basic economic supply and demand. And so if all the capital is chasing this other group and very little capital is chasing what is ostensibly 65% or more of the population, you're going to be able to pick the best of that 65%, and there's less competition for deals there. And so the deals you do in that demographic are likely to just be better deals because you've had less competition, you get to pick the best of them. And if we agree that there's parity in terms of expertise and talent, we're just, you know, fishing out of basically a bucket, and the fish are right there relative to the rest of the market who's all going after the same few people.
Right. And in fact, because of the size of that market, you have a bigger pool of talent with less fisherwomen out there at the same time, to use your analogy. So not everyone listening is an expert on venture capital. And so venture capital requires capital from investors to start with. And so what was the reaction when you went to people? I mean, who did you go to anyways, whether you could share names or companies or types of investors? I'm curious about how your pitch for what you just described was received, and maybe even how you learn to revise and adjust that pitch, because it'd be unusual for someone to get it perfect right off the bat.
Sure, that's a good question. And I'd say the honest answer is that it's a work in progress. We're still a relatively new fund. We started right before quarantine. my team, we've all been involved investing and building companies, but kind of all together focus on this particular strategy. It's new. And to your point, we learn as we go. And there have been some upside surprises as well as downsides. So an example of an upside is coming in, I didn't expect significant uptake because people tend to like doing what they do. To get someone to do something different is usually challenging. So I didn't want to come in with rose-colored glasses. And with that as a backdrop, I assumed that high net worth individuals and family offices would be the first port of call because generally they tend to be a bit more nimble, more willing to take a bit of risk, whereas institutions and corporates tend to be extra conservative. And so I expected that to be the case. And that's held true, except something happened in 2020 that we couldn't have predicted. And it wasn't only COVID, it was, you know, the death of George Floyd and a lot more focus on equity and, you know, the disparities in our society. So lo and behold, a number of corporates came out and said they're going to allocate specific resources to help bridge that gap. And so that's an upside surprise we couldn't have expected. And an example of benefit to us is we've gotten a commitment from Bank of America to participate in our fund. And so that's a big deal. We don't take it for granted. You know, they did a fair amount of diligence, but, you know, it's a nice signal that it's not just Jacques Philippe who thinks the idea is good. The second largest bank in the United States did their diligence and they like the team and they like the strategy. They think there's some veracity there and that they and their investors can reap some real financial benefit. So that's an example of the upside. The downside, I wouldn't say it's downside because I didn't think it was going to be easy, as I said, but there are definitely plenty of people who don't believe in this thesis at all. And I'm talking like really smart people who I think, you know, have done well. I don't discount their intelligence. But they really fundamentally believe that women and various marginalized groups just don't have the skill and expertise and talent to do as well as, you know, the groups that have been getting the capital. I was speaking with one such individual who like literally was a founder of one of the most successful venture funds in the United States. He then built a massive company. He's done super well. And part of his reason, because I, you know, I asked some questions, was he feels, for example, that in order to do well as a venture fund, and especially as an entrepreneur to build kind of the next significant companies of our time, you need to have a computer science background. You need to have a tech background. And he quoted some numbers suggesting that women and Black and Latinx folks don't have those degrees at a high enough clip. And therefore, they're just not going to be able to create solutions to significant challenges and drive the kind of alpha that is required for a venture fund. And therefore, he just doesn't believe in the thesis. Obviously, I disagree, but I just wanted to give you kind of the full spectrum of the types of things. And, you know, I hear everything in between as well.
Right. That is really striking. I mean, it's not surprising that there's a wide diversity of viewpoints on this, but this particular individual and probably a bunch of others as well, there are all sorts of flaws in that argument. And it's not hard to say that logic is sexist and racist. I'm sure you didn't say that. I assume you didn't say that.
No.
But if you're tapping into 2/3 of potential entrepreneurs, I suspect there'll be plenty of representation of computer science degrees and everything else under the sun. Maybe not at the same percentage or rate as in more, say, privileged groups, but you don't need 100% market share of anything. But okay, I mean, that just shows you some of the challenge, but that's in some ways to your advantage. As long as you can raise the money, it's still to your advantage because those people are not going to be looking where you're looking.
Exactly.
And that's good.
And I guess that's something I should add, given, you know, part of the tenure where we're going here around capital. So myself and my co-founders, one of them actually is a Dartmouth grad as well. He's built 7 companies, the last of which was the fastest to a $2.4 billion valuation. He speaks 7 languages. He's Brazilian-American. His name's Kane Conti. And then the other one, similarly, you know, McKinsey, Morgan Stanley, Harvard Business School, all the different things. So for us, we've all been investors and founders. And so we're coming to the venture space, not just as investors. Like, we really enjoy investing. We enjoy mentoring and supporting others. And I think, you know, you and I have been connected for a long time. You probably see that in my body of work. I just like helping people. And I actually see venture as a way of doing so because you give capital, but then you help them, you give them access, you do different things. So we're all about the investment side of things. But then on the capital side and some other aspects of the venture business, we think it's fundamentally broken. and the capital element, we were aware that that's probably one of the areas where we might have some challenges, right? Because LPs haven't historically backed that sector. And so we actually have another source of capital as well, because we're optimizing the venture capital process through the use of tech and collective expert intelligence. And so we've developed a whole community alongside our fund, which is growing rather rapidly. And the relevance of it to the capital bit is, once we have a deal that we've sourced, we've evaluated, we like it, we invest, we allow our community to invest alongside us. And the relevance of that is, whereas historically, you know, most funds, it's all their committed capital that they're investing in deals. For us, we can invest the committed capital, but then we can also invest from our community. And for us, as a matter of business, it doesn't actually make much difference because we get fees on everything. And so I see a future where we have a platform model that allows us to attract resources from a broader set of sources and at a larger clip that allows us to really meet the massive needs that are out there, right? Like, we care about sustainability, health and wellness, education, future of employment. Those are massive challenges. And the typical venture fund just doesn't have the capital to do so. And so part of what we're doing, like one of the innovations, is setting ourselves up to not be as beholden on the same capital sources that traditional funds have been beholden to.
So how big is this network that you've assembled so far?
So far, we're at about 600 core members of our community. Yeah, obviously we have others like larger communities and stuff, but core members who have signed up to the Ozone community because they see the value, you know, whether it's they're curious about the sectors, they want to know about what's happening across the board, or also because we incentivize our community because we share a portion of our carried interest with the top point earners. So people get points for sourcing deals, for participating in evaluations, for supporting portfolio companies. And the top 10% of our point earners actually get a portion of our carried interest. So there's a financial incentive. And then there are people who are angel investors. Well, the reality with angel investors is most of them actually don't make money. And if they do, it's not better than the public markets on a risk-adjusted basis because they do it passively. They're not sourcing enough deals. They're not evaluating them well enough. They're not able to support them. So by being part of our community and investing alongside us, they piggyback on our entire process. So it should increase their likelihood of actually making money. And so people become part of our community for many different reasons. And so I see a future where, you know, if we have this conversation a few years from now, our community is large enough that the top of our funnel is many, many times more robust than the typical venture fund, right? So if you speak to the typical top quartile venture and you ask them, why have they been so successful? One of the common answers is we see all the deals and we really scan the earth to make sure everybody comes to us. Where we've set up a process that makes that institutional. Like, we're going to see what a typical fund would see times a massive number because they're coming from a broad community. And then the bottom of the funnel, you know, certain funds will tell you they do very well because they evaluate very well. They're super focused. They know the sector. They understand it. So for us, the bottom of our funnel is extra tight because the diligence is not only done by our core team, but we'll have 30, 40, lately we've been getting 60 or more people who want to participate in the evaluation. And so what happens is they see the information, they're able to ask questions, it all happens seamlessly and virtually. It's anonymized. They see each other's information, but again, it's anonymized. And at the end of the day, the qualitative information that's provided is converted to quantitative info. And we get a scale, we get a number between 1 and 100. And if it meets our threshold, we're more likely to participate. I sometimes joke and call it post-ego investing. So I think I'm smart, and my co-founders think they're smart as well. But what we found with these types of decisions is that the collective almost always outperforms any one, two, or three individuals. And especially if you think about diligence, I may see a company that I think is amazing, but what if there's another one doing the same thing on the other side? I just didn't know they existed. By having more eyes and ears, we just get more info, more data that allows us to make a more robust decision. So that's another benefit of kind of the community and, you know, why people want to participate, as well as supporting the companies. Once they make it through, they get the support of a much broader set of individuals. So for founders, And we're already starting to see this. So we've made 9 investments in the last few months. And whereas before we made investments, we thought this might be the case, that we'd be super supportive and everything else, but it was speculative. Now we're getting feedback from these founders that they're getting substantially more support from us than they typically would get from a venture fund. And logically, that just kind of makes sense, right? Because if we have a broad set of folks in our community who have a vested interest in the success of this company, when that company is looking for a new head of tech, or they're looking for a salesperson, or they're looking to access various markets, our network and our resources are just super expansive, and we can, you know, make those things happen far easier. So, you know, those are some of the attributes of our platform that really excite me with respect to, you know, what I see as, you know, the future of VC to a certain extent.
Yeah, that's really an interesting explanation of what you're doing. It's easy to see. Invention is the mother of necessity. Is that how it goes? You didn't get access, and we'll never get access to some
need,
of the biggest
funds. Need is the mother of invention.
There you go. Something like that. And so you invented a new model. I had on the Sidcast someone named Maynard Webb. I don't know if you know the name, maybe last year. He used to be the chairman of Yahoo, and he's on the board at Salesforce and Visa and a real elder statesman in Silicon Valley. And he has created something analogous to what you're talking about with a broad network of people. And the expectation for those people is that they're going to help. He's all about helping. He doesn't need to make any more money, although he's not against it, to be sure. But he's all about helping. I'll have to connect the two of you because he'd be interested to hear what you're up to. Now, you said something about angel investors, that most of them don't make any money or make the same money as public markets. Well, I've had angel investors on. I can't say they've ever told me that. So this could be breaking news. But that's because you said they're passive investors. So they find something, they invest in it, and they leave it, and they do all their other stuff. So it becomes more of a hit and miss type of thing. Is that really what you've seen? Is there data actually to support that, or is there something you've seen in your own business?
Yeah, no, I've kind of seen it from just speaking with angel investors, but if you look it up, the data is out there. And conceptually, it kind of makes sense because the reality is that even professional venture investors, where their business is to make investments in early stage companies and make a profit for themselves and their investors, and they do that 24/7 is their job. And even in those instances, most of them do not outperform the public markets. And it's for the reasons I just mentioned. They don't source enough, they don't evaluate well, they don't support well. And that's what they do 100% of the time. Whereas the typical angel investor is someone who has money, they probably have a job, they have kids, they have a lot of things they're doing. They're not seeing a ton of deals a month, they're seeing a handful of deals a year. Some of those deals are from, you know, their friends, the children of their friends, it's people they know. They have a tough time saying no. And then they're not necessarily experts in the sector. Like literally, you're going to expect them to be a bit worse than the venture funds who do that full time. And if the venture funds most of the time are not outperforming the public markets, then angel investors are doing probably a standard deviation worse. And there is data out there if you look into it.
I mean, it's interesting because it's not the presumption that many people have from the outside. And that includes, you know, very highly educated people as well, who maybe it's because, you know, you look at, for example, the Zuckerbergs and the Gates, and both of them dropped out of Harvard and lots of others did too. And these guys, you know, become multi-billionaires and have created legacy companies that are going down already in the history books as the most influential in the history of business. And so we look at those. It's like the lotto winners. Yeah, look, so-and-so won the lotto. But we're not aware of all the people that have lost. It's the same thing. It's actually quite common, isn't it? It's like, you know, your friend goes to Vegas and they only tell you about if they won a little bit of money. The fact that they lose 9 out of 10 times, we don't quite hear that. They saw a good show. So
That's right.
It's completely believable. It's completely believable. What about on the investment? So what kind of companies have you been investing? Can you share any examples?
Sure. So high level, we look to back companies that are solving for what we consider to be consequential challenges of our time. We have an acronym. We call it the SHE categories, S-H-E-E, sustainability, health and wellness, education, future of employment. We include fintech and future of employment. And now specifically, some of the companies, I mean, personally, I've been very excited about them. So there's one, for example, that has developed a new physics kind of tech for engines for electric vehicles. So imagine the same form factor, but putting out 2 to 3 times the power. And so whether it's a scooter, a car, a plane, heating, ventilating, literally anything that uses a motor can benefit from this. So it meets our imperative of being better for the planet and environment and just energy consumption. But then, you know, one of the things that we always look to do is make strong returns for our LPs and ourselves. So we're usually looking for a minimum of 25x from our entry point valuation within 3 to 5 years. And this company has that quality to it because the market is just massive. It was one of our first investments. And since then, just in a year, we've helped them access over $100 million in revenues. We've helped them get something like $68 million in tax credits from the city of Fort Worth. They've raised more capital since then. We're actually about to take a bit more in the company at an earlier valuation. So that's an example of a company that we're super excited about. One of my co-founders came from the mobility space. Mm-hmm. So we were already quite steeped in the sector, knowing the players and how to fast track them. That company, when we got in, had no revenues. They had 48 patents. The team was impressive. We always want impressive teams, but we're able to fast track them from where they were to being more robust. And I think they appreciate that, and we appreciate it. So that's an example of a company we love. Another one is a bit more recent, but they're solving for something that is so timely: wildfires. And now we're in wildfire season again, and we're seeing all the news. Well, this team, again, the team is always first and foremost, amazing team. Their solution employs artificial intelligence and IoT kind of sensors to help prevent and remediate wildfires more effectively. And so they're able to sense the smoke or the fire almost immediately and notify the authorities. And I hadn't looked into this very closely before, but apparently with wildfires, the biggest issue is we're actually still reliant on people to see the fire and contact the authorities. And if it's too late and the fire's at a certain size, you just can't do anything. And so in as far as you can capture it early, then you're good. And they helped to solve for that. And this company, we're super excited. And the revenue streams are quite compelling to me. So you have the immediate pop from the sale of the physical equipment. But then you have the long-term contracts for the data. And the payers, if you will, it's everyone from municipalities, insurance companies, utilities. And now we're also realizing that certain large owners of property, because their property insurance has skyrocketed, especially in the Western United States, this helps to mitigate that and help them substantially. So that's a company, again, they're solving for something super important, saves lives, it's better for the environment. But then on the business front, the whole world is the market, and they're already seeing, you know, tremendous growth. And, you know, we like the prospects there. We've done a couple of deals in kind of health and wellness, digital marketplaces for traumatic illnesses, another one that's helping to deal with, to help identify breast cancer more effectively. So the prevailing way of identifying breast cancer is only effective for 70% of women, and that's if you're of European descent. All other women, the current model is about 50% effective. This team, which is led by an amazing young woman who's dealt with cancer herself, they have a much higher success rate of identifying breast cancer. And it applies to all women. And they already, like, literally we invested in that maybe 2 months ago, and they've already gotten the second largest insurance company in the country by doing a pilot with them. And, you know, for us, it just feels good. You're literally saving lives. And then the business side is massive, as you can imagine, because that's one of the biggest challenges for women globally. And then the last kind of category of investments that I'll share with you is something that if we spoke a year and a half ago, I probably wouldn't have mentioned it. We wouldn't have necessarily anticipated, but kind of within our future of employment category, we're seeing a lot of opportunity in the creative space, artists, creatives. You know, obviously, I know you through business school at Dartmouth. When we think about business, we think about engineering, we think legal, we think finance. There are certain things we consider, but when we hear someone's an artist, a musician, a painter, there's like millions of people who fit in that category. They tend to be on the fringes and oftentimes don't do very well. And so we've seen a few investment opportunities that we think can do quite well. One of them is at the intersection of NFTs and virtual reality. And they've created a platform that allows creatives to share their work more effectively with more people and monetize said work. The founders, there's a few founders, the main one, his last two businesses sold for $850 million and $1.2 billion respectively. And that one in particular, I met with the founder. When we started, I told him I thought the idea was ridiculous and we weren't likely interested. And within a 90-minute conversation, he helped me see what he sees. And I'm a huge believer now. They just closed an oversubscribed round last week. So Hopefully that gives you a little bit of a flavor for the types of companies we're seeing. And we're so bullish and excited about the quality of deals that we're seeing. And what I'll mention too, with respect to our work in generally, is that like for me, it hardly even feels like work. These are things that I would be doing anyway. And historically, I've sometimes done them through different channels simultaneously. I might have the job and I might be part of the nonprofit and I might be teaching, you know, toddlers martial arts on the weekend. Whereas now, the impact is built in, the investment stuff is built in, the entrepreneurial kind of drive and like shaking up an industry is built in, the camaraderie, the team that we have working on this together is built in. So for me, it's just super exciting.
That's really fabulous. I could see what you're talking about because I know you've always had your hand in a lot of different things and it all comes together here. Could you say a little bit more about the NFT and virtual reality, putting them together? It's got my attention. First of all, not everybody knows what NFTs are, even though they become this kind of crazy LeBron video that sold for, I don't know what it was, $1 million or something crazy. Yeah, could you say a little bit more about what that business is like?
Sure. So I'd say the most prevalent conversation around the NFTs relates to greater monetization opportunities for artists. So my daughter, who just turned 16, I told her for the summer, she'd look into NFTs because she's really into the arts. And so if you're an artist, historically, you might create a piece today and then you'll sell it to a buyer tomorrow. And let's say you sell it for $500. 10 years from now, that person may turn around and sell it for $5,000. And when they do that, you as the original creator of that piece get nothing because you sold it when you sold it for $500. Well, with NFTs, it allows you to create contracts, smart contracts around the sale of that item such that when it changes hands again, you automatically have some percentage of that locked in that you negotiated up front. So say you were Picasso, who is considered one of the most prolific artists ever. Like I think he literally created almost a piece a day. So every time those pieces would change hands, even now, his family would probably still be benefiting from the work that he did. The NFTs also allow you to sell the same piece at times to multiple people. And so that's where even me, I'm still...
You're still figuring that out. Yeah.
But it makes sense, right? Because why does someone buy a piece of art? They buy it because they like the art. They want to support the artist. It's an investment. They want to show off. If someone else owns a piece of that, it's kind of like when multiple people help create a building at a school, right? All their names are on the plaque. They're all kind of owners of that experience and it works. So that's built into the NFT. So as an artist, again, if you were going to sell that piece today for $500, you might have had three people who were interested and $500 was the highest price you got, or that's just what you sold it for. But if you can sell it to three people instead of one, and you sell it to each of them for $250, you probably would. And the NFTs allow you to do that.
Yeah. So Jacques-Philippe, this is a crazy idea, right? NFTs, virtual reality. Who comes up with this? I mean, what's their background? Are they artists? Are they tech people? Who comes up with ideas like this?
I mean, I have to be honest with you. For me, that's part of what makes this job so exciting because you get to meet the types of people who come up with these things. And they tend to be a little bit different. Right?
Yeah.
Like, they're a little quirky. And as mentioned with that particular company, and I told the founder when I first heard it, I was just like, all right, that's outside the scope of what I think
crazy.
Is reasonable.
Yeah.
And then he got me to see what he sees. And as I mentioned, they have four founders, but the primary person, he's steeped in the blockchain crypto space. So NFTs are still tied to the blockchain, right, for transparency and whatnot. So he understands that space. His last two companies sold for $850 million, $1.2 billion, and they were both related to crypto and block. So he understands that part of it. And what I like about that as well is if you go back to 2012, 2013, when he was doing those things, it was even more opaque, less clear, and you'd have to be even more off the beaten path to think you can do that. And he's that kind of person. So that's one part. Then he understands kind of the fundamentals of business, very thoughtful, strategic minded, which we like. But to your point, he's also steeped in the arts. He's like a virtuoso pianist and he's very connected to the art world. And apparently he has this thing, synesthesia or synesthesis, where he can perform to the energy of a room. And so he's like very empathetic and feels deeply. So I guess that's one of the...
I love that idea.
Yeah, that's
I love one that idea because every performer feels that to some extent. Even me as a teacher, you feel the class right away I've often said when I walk in, I miss this more than anything else during the Zoom time because you get zero of that, right, on the screen. But when I walk in the room, I could feel the energy and I could feel where they're at. And you react to that. And when you feel that positive feeling, you're like, okay, I got to be my absolute greatest because they deserve that. So I understand that. That's amazing.
Yeah, so he's that kind of performer and he feels it. And you get the sense that he's creating a solution for a problem he's experienced as an artist. And from a business perspective that he understands because he helped create kind of the underlying things that led us to a place where we can even wrap our minds around an NFT. And so, yeah, that's kind of part of it. And the reality is if we take a step back and you ask me the same question about all the other founders, they're all similar, right? Like the woman I told you who has the breast cancer solution, she dealt with it. Another one similar, like they all kind of have that. So those are some of the qualities that I find to be recurring, which we really like to see because one of the things you know and you know, hopefully most people understand, building a business, although it's exciting and people see it as this wonderful thing, I have yet to meet a founder who hasn't had significant challenges building it, right? It's almost impossible to raise money. It's really hard to develop the product. You have to manage these teams. So unless you're doing something that you really believe in and you're passionate about, you're not going to be willing to do what it takes to get it through to fruition. So, you know, a short answer to what kind of person does that is someone who's just super committed, who understands it, who really wants to solve for this thing. And it's one of the top priorities, basically, that they're living for in the moment.
Yeah. And how do you find these people? This is the network, again, that really generates a lot of the leads, right?
Yeah. So I'd say the answer is and or. So obviously myself, my co-founders, our venture partners, our advisors, we've been around for a while. We know people. And so we source deals kind of on par with other funds. And then, yes, the part that helps differentiate us is the broader community is also able to source deals, right? You're teaching. You're bound to meet students who are building something interesting. Historically, you didn't have an easy way to help them and potentially help yourself, right? Because when someone brings a deal to us, if it makes it through our process and we evaluate, they get something like 25,000 points, which is 10 times the number of points people get for doing most basic things. So you're almost guaranteed to have financial upside. And so if you think about it, we've set up a situation whereby we just make it easy for anyone who sees an interesting idea or a founder to say, hey, speak to my guys, right? And everybody likes to be an owner, and that's what we want. I'm not Ozone. Everyone's the Ozone. And so if you join our community, you're part of the Ozone community. So you speak to the next young person who's building, or old, doesn't matter, it's the next person who's building something. Like, I might be able to help you speak to my guys, and da 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 da. So that's how the top of our funnel ends up becoming more robust.
Yeah. Is that where the Ozone word was selected to represent that? Because it's always there, it's out there, it covers the world.
Absolutely. So that's definitely part of it. And I'm happy that we went with this word because the other part of the truth is that when we were starting on this journey, the Opportunity Zone legislation had just come out providing tax incentives for people to sell various securities and then reinvest it in certain parts of the United States and they get significant tax benefits and financial benefits. And so we were exploring all of that. And so the Opportunity Zone was part of it. But then I remember thinking, you never know where we're going to go with this. So Ozone is more all-encompassing. And I also like the idea that ozone scientifically is made of three molecules of oxygen. And oxygen tends to be associated with life and breath. And there's so many interesting ways that you can take it. And yeah, absolutely. That's like a core part of what we look at. If we're in, that means we're bringing life, we're being supportive, there's oxygen, and it's also safety, right? Since we're helping to solve for some of the biggest challenges of our time, the ozone layer is protecting the earth from, you know, certain harmful UV types of activities. So absolutely. Yeah.
What you just described is a really good example of how names and brands and symbolism is actually very important and shouldn't be a throwaway thing. It's worth all the time and energy to try to figure it out. Now, you know, you just described four different companies you're excited about. Obviously, they don't all win. And the general hit rate for venture capital is not very high in the first place. So as you said, you've been involved in various aspects of this type of work for a long time. When it doesn't work, why does that happen? What are the commonalities that you've seen when a startup, when a founder does not succeed?
I think the biggest reason tends to be at the team level. So differences of opinions and just challenges among the team. That's a big one. Another is access to capital. So the ability to scale, especially if you're in a sector that has some level of competition and the competition has deep pockets and a lot of capital for growth and you don't, that can be challenging. And then tying it back to what we mentioned before, kind of commitment and passion. So if someone is building a business simply for the sake of building a business because they think being a founder is cool and well-received in the market, then there's a good chance they don't make it through because the challenges are just beyond those that someone with that level of interest would stick it out for. And then, you know, there are certain things that are harder to foresee. So you create a solution based on the challenges that you see, but then the markets shift in a way that you didn't anticipate and your solution is no longer relevant. So that can be an issue. Recently, I was reading about kind of China and the fact that they've been buying up the inputs for the production of cell phones. But now many of the leading battery companies are developing ways of making those batteries that don't need that input. So if that were a business, it's like that's what it was. And you created a business to solve for that. But now the market shifted in a way that makes you obsolete. So that happens sometimes as well. The last thing I would say, though, even on that last one, is you typically want to back a team that's nimble enough that even when their original plan doesn't work out exactly as planned, they're able to pivot and set themselves up to still have something of note. Because apparently most companies at the very early nascent phase, whatever they said they were going to do, it typically ends up shifting significantly. So even the solar company that I created and ran, as mentioned, a lot of the interest for it came out of what I saw in Haiti and across the developing markets. And distribution did happen in those markets across 70 plus countries. But if you look at the company now, 90% of the product is actually used in developed markets, which wasn't even part of the plan, right? It's the US, it's Japan. And so you never really know how and where something's going to be used relative to your original idea. So plasticity and willingness to be flexible and learn as you go is super critical. Otherwise, you're likely to fail.
Yeah, and those attributes are important for pretty much everything in life. Learning as you're going, adaptability, adjusting, facing up to change in reality, embracing it. Those are true for companies, for leaders, for founders, but for big companies as well. And probably for a lot of people as they think about their own careers. I found the more I think about it, some of the kind of strategic logic that you think of for a company and their success or failure, a lot of it could be applied to personal life and personal careers. Like even your example of, you know, China buying up the inputs and now that might not be as valuable as before. Well, you know, you invest in a certain type of education or experience or background and, you know, turns out it's not that interesting anymore because AI has taken it over or there's a lot more competition and so there's not as much money to be made or you just don't find it as interesting. And so the ability to put yourself in a position to adjust is really the key thing. And that requires constant learning. And you got to love learning, you know, because some of the things you're going to learn are not going to be practical or useful. They're not going to pan out in any financial sense. And you don't know that ahead of time, but you got to still appreciate it because otherwise, you know, you're not going to go down that path. Yeah, so this is really interesting to learn more about what you're doing and kind of your profile of the companies. And obviously, I think everyone listening can tell how excited you are about some of these companies. So you've done, as I said, a lot of different things. I want to ask you my typical closing question on advice. You're actually in the business of giving advice in some ways to founders, but this is advice to yourself. If you can magically go back in time to when you were, say, 21 years old, and you could kind of you see, I don't know where you were at the age of 21, but if you can somehow magically go back in time and lean over to Jacques Philippe and say, there's one thing you want to do or not do, if there's one thing you want to know, if there's one thing you want to think about, what would that be? What would be that advice to yourself?
That's an excellent question. The first thing that comes to mind is trust yourself. Be authentic. Understand that you have all the answers within you. Don't follow the masses. So at 21, I was in college at Georgetown. You know, you're looking for jobs. You're kind of figuring out what you're going to do next. And I think a lot of people, including myself at the time, go with the masses, do the thing that seems to be the norm. You know, irrespective of the reason, oftentimes for financial benefit or otherwise. So like my major overarching piece of advice would be to do the thing that you're most passionate about and do it fully. And you're more likely to go 100% and give it your full effort if you really love it and you're committed to it. And even though it may seem like it's not the most direct path to making a lot of money if you're motivated by money, trust me when I tell you that if you do that thing that you love, the money and everything else that you want is going to come anyway. Whereas if you go after something that is not really core to who you are and your interests and your passions, even if you get the capital, it's going to be fleeting. It's not going to be as fulfilling. And it's likely not to be as big in the long run as it would otherwise be if you really locked in and were committed to being your truest self.
Yeah. The one thing about that that I always find interesting is how do you know what your passion is when you're 21 years old? And of course, some people do. Many people don't. How do you know, or how do you find out? How do you put yourself in a position to find out where you should go all in? Because if you know it, I get it. But if you don't know it,
I guess what I would say there is be willing to take the risk, right? And you're right. Most 21, even if you think you know, you probably don't know what you should be doing. But chances are you have a few things that are of interest to you, and take the risk. Try one, try two, quickly pivot when you realize it's not the one. But just don't allow other people to dictate what you do with your time, because later on, you're not going to be answering to those other people. You're going to be answering to yourself as to why you made those decisions.
I think that's the heart of the matter. You got to follow what you want to do. And okay, you might not know exactly what it is, so you experiment. That's the logical thing to do, as you just said. But to do what other people tell you to do, that's no fun. And at some point, you're going to rebel against yourself and against other people.
And it's very common, like that one too. There's a book I read some time ago by Deepak Chopra, The 7 Laws of Success or Spiritual Laws of Success, something along those lines. And what I'm touching upon here in that tradition, they call the Dharma. So in as far as your actions, your thoughts, your words are aligned, you just tend to do better. It's very easy to articulate that, but it's actually very difficult for most people to do that. In that book, Deepak talks about that construct within the fact that he's also a father and kind of the way that he raised his daughter. And so at no point did he tell his daughter to do things that she didn't want to do. She always did the things she wanted to do. And that's a very unconventional way of parenting. But it led to a very confident, self-actualized woman who learned everything else. Right? Because when you go deep in whatever it is you're interested in, generally, you're going to learn the math of it. You're going to learn the science. You're going to have to know how to read and write. Like to do anything fully, you're going to use all the tools anyway. So it actually becomes a way of getting great at all the other tools because you're doing that thing that you love. And so that was one of the places I saw it articulated very well.
Right. Yeah. And that's living with purpose in a sense and figuring out what your purpose is and how you create meaning, which everyone does, whether they know it or not. They will do it and they do it. I think the more thoughtful we can be, the better, because there are big implications to the moves that we make. That's really good advice and great discussion. Thanks so much for being on the Sidcast, Jacques-Philippe Piverger. And it's exciting to kind of catch up and hear what you're doing. I love these business ideas. I hope all of the ones that you just described are going to win big, because they would do a lot of great things, not just for you and your investors, but for the world. Jacques-Philippe, thanks so much for being on the Sidcast.
Absolutely. Thank you, Sid. It's a real privilege and an honor to be here. I've been following your Sidcasts for years. I never thought I'd be invited to participate myself. I thank you. And, you know, I look forward to doing a lot more with you in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Sidcast. I'm really excited to be bringing you season 3. And really appreciative that you've chosen to listen to this episode. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the series and you will never miss a single episode. I welcome all feedback and I'd love to hear from you. I've gotten some great commentary over the course of the first 2 seasons and lots of great suggestions as well. You can contact me via my website, www.thesidcast.com, or you could email me directly at sidfinkelstein@gmail.com. If you like what you heard, I hope you'll tune into another one of our episodes, and please give us a 5-star review and share with others who you think would enjoy and benefit from the show as well. The Sidcast is produced by the Podcast Laundry Production Company.